Nick, is SaaS dead?
Questions around growth, multiples collapsing, layoffs everywhere you look.
But the world is running on all of these companies currently. Do they just get swept out? What happens here? Or are they just going to adapt?
I don't know. We'll see. Maybe the market is trying to understand if there is a technology problem. Or maybe we're looking at a business model reset. Maybe both.
That's what we're here to discuss. And that's why we've got Frank with us today, covering SaaS at Arc. Frank, the disaster, as coined by none other than Brett Winton, is this an issue or is this just temporary fears?
Both.
Coming out swinging.
Yeah.
I mean, uncertainty has risen dramatically about the sustainability of future cash flows or expectation of future cash flows for most, if not all, software companies. For things that we've been talking about for a long time, but are now starting to like bubble up to the surface of the market, which is AI models continue to progress and get cheaper, and they're very good at building software. And now that software won't get shipped into and deployed into enterprises by itself, which is why I think there's still a business model for creating software that enhances knowledge worker productivity within a business. But will the companies that do that 5 years from now be the same as the existing companies? I don't think so. Some will survive and do well, but I think there'll probably be a big consolidation relative to those that don't. And the space is getting re-rated generally with a lower multiple because of that rising uncertainty. The barriers to entry to create software are so low. You can copy features very quickly. And I think the teams that are nimble and shipping very fast will do better than the teams that are relying on, oh, well, my customer always renews and expands a little bit, and that's enough to fund my sales and marketing and R&D for next year.
Can I present you with some stylized facts and see how you respond to them?
Sure.
Okay. Well, one, it's like at the Bessemer Cloud Index, which is kind of like all of the SaaS companies with the exclusion of the mega cap tech type companies. You can buy that today at a cheaper forward revenue multiple than you've ever been able to, at least since 2014, 3.6. If you scroll down there, you can see it. There you go. And so at least the median company. And if you do some math on the Bessemer Cloud Index, you take kind of like growth rate, fleet, free cash flow margin, make an assumption, a consistent assumption about growth decay, then you can end up with a payback period. How long do you need to own the business until you get back your free cash flow for having owned it, and assuming some dilution? And it's gone from kind of year by year. Now we're at a 12-year payback period. Last year at this time, 18 year payback period, year before 20, the year before 24, and then back in peak COVID, 37 years. So on the one hand, it's like, yes, multiples have compressed. On the other, do I want to own free cash flow coming from a software business, even for 12 years, counting on over two business cycles, this thing actually paying me out? What do you think? Is it still too high? As in kind of given the amount of uncertainty to come, like, is even 12 years too long a hold period to be like, I'm going to get my money back?
Wait, what was it at? What was it 3 years ago?
February of, you mean 25, 24, 23?
Yeah.
24 years. I mean, that makes an assumption. At the time, free cash flow margins for the businesses were, the median business was at 1%. So I'm assuming you can get 10% free cash flow off it. So at 1%, it was basically infinite because your dilution was in excess.
Gotcha. Nick, you said run.
But
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, the question obviously is very binary. Is SaaS dead? No, not likely. But is it going to be wildly more competitive? It has to, right? Like, if the marginal unit of knowledge is now headed towards zero and labor constraints are no longer necessarily a factor because you have AI agents running wild into the internet, it seems like you're going to have VCs funding new AI native SaaS companies. And then you're going to have the behemoths, the large cap tech companies trying to featureize what have traditionally been like vertically integrated or vertical SaaS companies. And to me, that just seems like, you know, I think the question I'll pose it to Frank is, I think the concern comes around pricing power, right? Your next deployment, your next solution out into the market, what can you really price that at when there's going to be 15 to 20 different versions of it out there? And I think you've done incredible work with the help of Joseph and trying to like understand SaaS versus PaaS. And so, yeah, I'm curious what you think in the context of the research you've done.
We've observed this trend for a while. If you just look at the growth rates of companies that are building SaaS applications versus companies that are building like infrastructure software and platform as a service offering. So I like generalize the two into application, like software for end business users versus software for developers to build and scale either end applications or some kind of backend service. And platforms along with the clouds that power them have been growing much faster than SaaS apps for a while. And I think AI is likely to accelerate that outside of growth in like what you called, which I think is right, new AI native SaaS apps, which like ChatGPT and Claude for Enterprise are examples of that are growing very quickly. So I think there's still going to be growth, and I think there's going to be way more software in 5 years than there is now. But the composition of that is going to look different. And I think like one of the things I've been thinking through is the companies that are going to stand out and do well and grow in this environment are the companies that are taking this new raw material, which is digital intelligence in the form of tokens, and applying it and delivering it into an enterprise in a unique and valuable way, and that align their business model in delivering those intelligence tokens. So you can see Palantir does this, where they basically take your enterprise data sitting in a bunch of different systems, they contextualize it into an ontology, and then they make it very easy to build agents on top of that that basically combine your business data with LLMs to deliver business productivity, and they charge based on that, and their business is growing in the US 100% plus year on year and accelerating. And then every other SaaS company, for the most part, is decelerating revenue because they're not based on, adding additional value to inference tokens. They're based on seat-based pricing.
Okay. Well, every other SaaS company, like publicly traded incumbent existing SaaS company. I think If you look at the venture-funded AI space, and this goes to Nick's point, like these companies are printing revenue growth ramps, like the likes of which have never been seen, and potentially evaporating as they're doing it. Like look at Windsurf, which is kind of like a wrapper on top of GPT to deliver encoding agent capability. They had a great-ish exit, but mostly because they got acqui-hired. And Cursor, which is still growing very quickly, and who knows, maybe Cursor is in great shape, but at the margin, it's pretty clear that Cursor, which is another kind of similar wrapper on top of, GPT and Claude, like coding agent, is in big strategic trouble because, OpenAI and Anthropic are saying, hey, that looks like a useful application you have there. Mind if I just embed it into the core functionality of my platform? And good luck with the remaining marginal users that will continue to use it through your front end wrapper. So it seems like there is like high rates of growth. The public are the incumbents that have an existing software product and are like, hey, you can do this little LLM feature on top, seem to be having trouble translating that dongle into like a meaningful uptick in growth, including like if you look at the behemoth, Microsoft, Copilot subscriptions are a small fraction of Office 365 subscriptions. So they're clearly not getting kind of in their core software suite the kind of growth that probably they would want for what's supposed to be this huge unlock of capability. Like why it seems like there's a mismatch between these companies' ability to kind of deliver on this promise versus kind of the companies that are starting from scratch, building on top of the promise and their ability to deliver growth.
Okay, but quick question here. So it sounds like you and Nick are saying current SaaS incumbents are more like the newspaper industry where it's just...
Is that a technical term?
What? Yeah, that's I believe that is in the textbooks. As opposed to, say, let's look at banking or retail, where tons of disruption in both of those areas. But it's like, oh, this bank's terrible. They can't even figure out this. They can't even figure that. Oh, the big banks still got bigger. It's like, obviously, you know, there were network effects. Sure, there's new wave banks, and there's been tons of investment in kind of banks 2.0, but the big banks have done fine and are, I think, are bigger than ever. And same thing with retail, right? I was reading, Nick flagged this, the A16Z, I think Steven Sinofsky put this out, but it's like retail, you know, the big adapted to e-commerce, and everyone thought Walmart was going to be dead in the water. And it's like, ah, actually, it's fine. They figured it out. And now both Amazon and Walmart are kings here. And so it's like, you look at something like Salesforce, which I don't think has ever been hard to replicate. You know, does it be easier to replicate matter to them or not?
I think, Sam, what you're pointing out is there's some nuance in, you know, understanding what is happening with this disruption, as in, is all SaaS dead or is all SaaS, you know, under pressure? Well, if you look at the market, all SaaS is under pressure, but are they all dead? And I think you have to ask yourself as a question, like a question is really like, what is a core product versus what is a feature that can be bundled into a larger service? So like, if you think about some of these vertical SaaS players, that's where I think there's concern for me. When you look at like a suite of tools like Microsoft, like to think that Microsoft can't figure this out, like in the same way that you gave the analogy to e-commerce, Walmart and some of these other big players couldn't figure out how to adapt to their environment, I don't think it's true. Like, I think they will figure out how to bolt on AI and you know, ride this wave. It may be turbulent and maybe, you know, you see more cascading effects, but eventually I think you figure out how to instill these products into the core feature. Or the core product and featureize, you know, some of the offerings out there. So, like, I think that is where the nuance lies. It's not, you know, but the market's not treating it in that way.
Right. That means there's opportunities.
Right.
And to be fair, like, to the comments on Salesforce, like, if I was just looking up, like, their Agentforce and data products are at $1.4 billion in ARR, growing over 100% year on year. And so, you know, I described Palantir, whose whole business is growing that quickly. But if you look at these products within some of the big SaaS footprints, they have a lot of room to deploy into their existing customer base that, if they do well and continue to grow, will start to move up the top line. I don't think the market believes that that's very durable right now, but we'll see over time. Also, you know, the Agentforce is a smaller subset. It's like less than... it's about $500 million in run rate, not $1.4 billion. That's their
product. Yeah, and applying the same thing I did to the Bessemer Cloud Index, Salesforce CRM would be like a 15-year payback period. So do you trust, kind of like given its growth rate and expectation for growth decay and its free cash flow margin, that you could kind of like, you know, hold on to that business for 15 years and then get your cash flow back, and then everything else on top of that is gravy, like given where they're at in terms of kind of their strategic platform?
I don't know. I think it's a good question. It's like, do I think OpenAI in 15 years versus, I don't know, some of the best SaaS companies in 15 years? I think that's...
isn't the real tell that OpenAI and Anthropic use Salesforce and Slack internally? At least that's the rumor. Like, if they could replace it, wouldn't they have done it already?
I think it's not going to make sense for a business to build their own CRM. Like, that's kind of obvious. So Salesforce is still going to be around. I would bet that in 5 years they have more customers than they have today. But if I had to bet on who's going to capture more of a multi-trillion-dollar AI TAM,
right,
I'm going to bet on these new AI native companies over most or all of the traditional SaaS companies, because the businesses were just formed around a model that's fundamentally different. And some of them maybe will have outsized outcomes, but
I think that's the secret, if you look at kind of like our AI software expectations, you have a huge acceleration in the overall software market, you know, from today, and that's going to be you know, mostly driven by AI products, you know, making kind of AI agents and everything that makes enterprises more productive. But those agents are going to use underlying tooling. It's not like they're going to write everything from scratch. You know, you wouldn't expect kind of like them to build their own, I don't know, operating systems and computers and everything else, or, you know, databases. But they'll be somewhat ruthless at like swapping out underlying pieces of the infrastructure over time to more economical models. And so kind of I think that the, call it, you know, strategic protectiveness of any SaaS company is a little challenged, but actually maybe top line growth will be easier than expected, with the wrinkle that you have to try to change your business model to no longer be charging on a seat base to some kind of like engagement base, because the agents, if you're just charging an agent a single seat and an agent's working a million miles per hour and doing, you know, all kinds of stuff, then utilization of your software will go way up, but you won't capture any of the revenue. So there's also the business model mismatch, which is a little challenging
but,
for these
but
companies.
It's like that transition has been made, right? If we went back 10 to 8 years ago, it was, you know, there were choppy quarters because these companies were going from selling just the outright software to subscription based, and it's like, oh, everyone needs to be subscription based. And I'm sure we're going to have that where everyone needs to get to value based, and those who do it are going to benefit far more than those who can't. But Brett, your topic there brings up a point that Nick and I were discussing, which we should discuss here. Is innovator's dilemma solved? Nick, you think
yes. Go ahead, Nick.
Well, I go back to, and I'm throwing the question out there. I haven't come to a conclusion yet, or like at least an opinion on it. It's more when you have, you know, think about it from a constraint perspective. If, you know, the reason not to go after your disruptor is because you had to have historically taken capital in the form of labor, so like your best employees that are working on your core product, and move them over to a new, essentially internal upstart to try and disrupt your own business, doesn't it then make sense that the dilemma in that gets wildly easier because you don't have to deal with labor internally? You can just deploy more compute at it and solve the problem and, you know, run your own internal competitive solution until the time it, you know, passes your core. So you essentially disrupt yourself, and there's more willingness to try and disrupt yourself. One, because the market is moving faster, but two, you don't need to actually deploy human and physical resources to it. You just need to spend API tokens or whatever it may be.
I mean, go on, Frank, please.
My point of view is that I could see the decision getting easier in that you have lower cost of experimentation and you can't blame it on, oh, I have this great headcount that I don't want to have, try that. But I think the decision to disrupt your own business model is still a hard decision that companies face regardless of the underlying resource cost to do it.
Right.
Yeah, classically, the innovator's dilemma is not a question of resource constraints or labor constraints. It's that companies, really well-run companies, are companies that listen carefully to their customers, and the large market pocket that they're listening to does not want the thing that the new technology is offering. So in LLMs, it would be, oh, you know, I can't stand any hallucinations in my software. And so then therefore do not offer me probabilistic software. That's not what I want. I need something that writes to my database so I know exactly it's precise. Ignoring the fact that the database is full of errors, but they're pretending that's not there. You know, and so then a company that is very well run listens to those customers and then looks at the margin structure of the product that's coming and says, oh, okay, so this is a technology that's in too small a pocket to make sense for us from a delivering us growth perspective at a lower margin structure than we already have, and our customers don't want it. And so then typically they say, this is, you know, go with God, those that are pursuing this. This is a bad use of capital for anybody, including these challengers that are coming after us. And that's how, so it's not a resource constraint problem. It's the companies are too successful at what they do to recognize kind of like the new technology for what it could be, because on every marginal move looks like it's unwise to step into that opportunity. And I think a reason it could be different here is not because those structural things are, well, a couple of things in AI. One, you could argue it actually has come to pass to some degree. Anthropic and OpenAI are going to be the, you know, call it third and fourth largest software companies in the world by revenue, leaving aside Microsoft and Google, but against core SaaS, probably next year. And so why should they, under-resourced, kind of like these companies that, you know, launch a chatbot that caused, you know, all kinds of political and you know, egg on your face disasters, why should they be so large? It has to be because the more well-resourced companies kind of like decided not to pursue that path in some degree, to some degree. All of like Silicon Valley has read that book. And so I think like Google's response is to come back and be like, no, we have to treat this seriously. You know, you can't just kind of like bureaucracy your way to doing this. And for a long time, it looked like they were bureaucracying their way to like not compete. And so a founder coming back, or a founder having control and saying, I am steering aggressively in this direction, despite the fact that my own internal organization, a lot of it rebels against me as I do so, is kind of one solution. And then the other solution, the other reason this could be different, is because AI is so obviously so large an opportunity. So it's not, you know, they don't, it's not like the hard drive industry, which is the classic example in Clayton Christensen, where you had, you know, big drives that had lower cost per megabyte, and their customers were wanting lower cost per megabyte, and they looked at small drives that have higher cost per megabyte but happen to be able to fit on a, you know, in a desk, and say, oh, we're not interested in that. That's not what our customers want. And besides, nobody's going to want a computer on the desk anyway. That's not going to be a form factor that wins. And as it turns out, that was the form factor that won. And so here you have our report saying, hey, this is a $7 trillion AI software opportunity by 2030. And they look at that and they say, hey, I need a piece of that actually to continue to be a dominant force in the ecosystem. And so then are willing to take big resources and make big bets on that, because they at least recognize that, hey, the margins might look different now, but the overall opportunity is so big that we have to step into it. So combination of founders still being in control, which I think is really important, kind of like the market being meaningfully large, even relative to megacap tech, you know, also being important. And the fact that they've all read the book, I think, does change the dynamics to some degree.
All right. And I shared this screen earlier, but I'll share it again. Talk about an example where the innovator's dilemma is alive and well. You know, last week, another write-down, a massive write-down from Stellantis on their EV business here. And it's interesting, right? This write-down is bigger than Tesla's CapEx for its massive transition into autonomous and robotics, right? So you just have pretty much every major automaker giving up on electric at a time when we think we're about to transition past electric to autonomous.
But Sam, this is remnants of pre-AI world where innovator's dilemma was alive and well. We're talking post-AI.
Also, Brett said only the people in Silicon Valley read the book, so maybe it didn't make its way to Detroit.
I mean, I think in the auto space, I still don't understand why there's not like a compelling tech forward neighborhood electric vehicle that has been sold into the market that people can ride around in. I still think that the market for that should exist. And that would be like an innovator's dilemma. Like, we're going to sell a car at a price point that people don't think really exists, that can't go on the highway. And that'll be the foundation by which we collect a lot of data to then deliver an autonomous strategy. Somebody should have, that's what Apple probably would have done if Steve Jobs hadn't died. That's my, you know, firm belief, where it's like you compete in like a totally different kind of area than the existing market is competing in for a set of characteristics that are different from what people are focused on from the existing buyer set.
In China, you're right, there was a temporary micro car boom that kind of got quelled by regulation. Nick, I don't know if you saw what I sent you. There's now a micro drama boom in China. Had you heard of that before?
The like AI written micro dramas that are taking place now, they're spreading like wildfire on TikTok.
No, they're in the US. There's a bunch of startups that are trying to do it in the US media market, right?
Just going back to the neighborhood electric vehicle, isn't the equivalent in the US just golf carts? I feel like I see golf carts everywhere.
Well, but my point is like design like a nice golf cart. As in the golf cart market.
It just cost you a pretty penny. Or about Moke America? Frank, we used to see them all the time. They're all over St. Pete.
Really? Moke America?
Yeah, MOKE.
I'm actively considering getting one.
Really? Yeah. Is there a tagline, Moke America Great Again?
It's like if you could have a hybrid between a golf cart and a Jeep Wrangler, and it was kind of, you know, beachy and electric.
I think the problem with these is they don't survive. It's like, imagine someone in their Escalade runs a red light, then it's game over. So it's like, I don't know, it's kind of prisoner dilemma as far as car size in the US.
Yes, that's true. You basically need a bigger and bigger tank to survive all the other tanks on the road.
Okay.
I do think like that's when like robotaxi infiltration of cities could really change cities in an interesting way. As in, it's like clearly the biggest risk for my kids and my family is cars, pedestrian, bikes, all that stuff. And so I'm paranoid about that. You don't want to increase your risk in your biggest risk pocket. And if we could just like have no humans driving anymore, it would be so much safer for people to use other modes of like, getting around. Moke. Yeah, to drive their Moke, exactly.
Okay, one other topic, you know, Bitcoin also, I won't say Bitcoin, crypto generally really had a rough week last week. This was a chart of the week that Nick suggested here. Brett, I want to get your reaction to it.
Well, I can't see what it says. You're saying
it's comparing Bitcoin treasury companies to the 1920s investment trusts. Do you need me to zoom
in? No, I mean, they are both graphs that go up and to the right. I assume it's the number of companies that we're looking at here.
I think it's the vehicle in which to acquire the underlying asset is the comparison. As in, you know, it seems novel that these DATs are around, but I think this chart shows that this has been tried before. It was just with equities, as in there were digital equity trusts in the early 1900s.
Yeah, digital. Yeah. They really.
But those were more like they were effectively mutual funds before mutual funds exists and before the kind of like regulatory structure around mutual funds exists. As in kind of you did those and you got access to a basket of equities all at once. Whereas the digital asset treasury companies, it's like crypto assets exist. We know they're interesting. There's a big pool of money that is still not really effectively able to invest in crypto assets because they are behind traditional financial rails and gatekeepers. And so, hey, we can have this like corporate shell in which I stick a crypto asset and suddenly it's available to these other people. And the challenge is one, like all the crypto asset companies are trying to make the assets directly available to this big pool of money. So it seems like this is like a temporary solution, but there are tax advantages to it in some geographies. It seems as if, yes, the leverage is building up in those digital asset treasury companies. And so kind of like the catastrophic unwind of this cycle, which maybe you could argue is happening, but has to begin killing off those treasury companies in order to like fully reset the market. I'm not going to make a claim that MicroStrategy is going to bankrupt here, but I think that we've all recognized that that structure seems a little wonky.
We did have a bit of an unwind recently. So Frank, you spend some time with our crypto team. What do you think happened there? Was this part of, you know, what Brett is describing? Do you think it was an unwind in the DATs or are there other rumors?
I don't think much related to the DATs for the latest sell-off. I mean, you can see this thing, I think, observed since like DAT mania wore off in, you know, around Q3 of last year, is that the DATs that, you know, reach this upper echelon of notoriety, like MicroStrategy and Bitmine, have been able to maintain a relative steady price relative to their assets and grow assets during certain periods, though at a much lower rate than they were growing earlier. And then there's this long tail of DATs that raised money and investors don't want much of anything to do with it anymore. So they're trading below the net asset value. And then the thing that seems short-term accretive to shareholders is to sell the assets and buy back shares. But if you still don't go back to neutral to positive premium to your NAV, and you keep trying to do that, you just liquidate the balance sheet. And we've been a lot of announcements of DATs selling in small bits because this is a minority of the overall market for months now. So I don't think there was anything bigger that happened last week. The latest rumor I saw over the weekend and heard from the crypto team this morning was lingering effects from hedge funds that were caught offsides during the 1010 flash crash back in October that now crossed like a 90-day threshold or getting close to it with regards to shoring up their collateral positions. So that could be it. The more general thematic thing that I ascribe to a bit is that crypto as an industry is much more mature than it was in prior cycles, and you kind of have this handoff happening between the early retail investors and more institutional, I'll say holders and adopters, because the Bitcoin ETFs have been around for a while, but institutional adopters as in people or large financial institutions actively using public blockchains or offering digital asset investment services to their clients. All of that is in a large part gatekept by the market structure bill passing in Congress. You kind of saw the wave of announcements that happened and the market excitement around Circle after the Genius bill passed last year. I think the market's kind of waiting for that market structure bill to pass to have like this next wave of adoption. And in the meantime, the AI market is super interesting. Retail speculation has moved to the prediction markets, and there's kind of this gap.
Are you saying for the first time in history, it's retail who's dumping their bags on institutions?
Well,
you know, the institutions are a collection of retail holders.
Yes, in many cases. But more, yeah, maybe selling before the institutions come. Yeah. I mean, it's also like such a meme in crypto that the institutions are coming. Like we've heard this for almost 10 years now.
They're here.
That's right. By the rumor,
They are here in spirit. They recognize that it's important and they're ready to build. But how many banks that talked about stablecoins have launched a stablecoin?
Right.
Okay, we kept this to a nice, tight 32 minutes here for next week. Drop questions in the comments that you want us to address, and we're going to take some and answer them as long as they're semi-relevant. We'll also answer one non-relevant one. So
even if they're irrelevant.
Yeah.
Please ask questions. We're happy. We want to answer. We want to make it more engaging.
All right. See everyone next week.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.